Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This episode is being recorded at NDC London on January 19, 2017. And we are talking to Richard Campbell about Humanitarian Toolbox and the stuff you've been up to with that.
Yeah. So, hi.
Hello.
This is weird.
It is weird.
The tables have turned.
Yes. We haven't literally turned the table, but, you know, here we are together anyway.
Metaphorically.
Yeah.
Metaphorical table turning.
We should be doing more of these together, John. We always talk about it, but we never get it done. But yeah, it's fun to not be running the show.
Absolutely. Yeah. So you were the keynote speaker yesterday.
I was, and happy to do it. Humanitarian Toolbox is an interesting turning point. I've done a bunch of talks and keynotes about HT for a while now, but they've mostly been aspirational. Just talk about what we think we have a model. This is the potential. Come help us make it come true. Yeah. And this was the one where I felt like I could actually give you my report card. Here's what we've built over the past couple of years and where we are with the software.
Now, how much of that was cramming the last 2 days right before the keynote?
Because we know we had a code-a-thon
you
here
did, yeah,
in
two
the
days,
UK.
Right?
There was about a dozen people that worked for the 2 days with us, and they all got at least one commit in.
Wow.
So probably about 30 of the 2,700 commits came Monday, Tuesday.
Okay. All right.
There's your proportion. So yeah, maybe 1%. Although, and one of the reasons we moved so quickly is that we had an old experienced hand in the already project. Steve Gordon was there.
Well, you have a really high powered team overall, right? I mean, there's some, now I'm guessing there were some walk-ins, but you also have some pretty smart people that are contributing.
Yeah. What's interesting about HTBox is the biggest contributors are not necessarily rock stars.
Okay.
Although we've had, you know, rock stars involved.
Right.
Shout out to Sean Wildermuth,
yeah,
who's been writing books around ASP.NET Core all along, and the already project is ASP.NET Core. And so we started development. The very first version of the already project, this Red Cross project, was actually built by the studio team.
Oh.
It was part of a promotion for Studio 2015, and they came to me saying, hey, we need to do a sample app, and if we make another Northwind, we're all going to shoot ourselves.
Right.
Can we have any ideas of something a little more real? And that was just as we were starting to have a conversation with a fellow by the name of Jim McGowan,
uh-huh,
who works for the Red Cross, and he was talking about this problem space of what would eventually become Already. And so it seemed very synergistic. I don't like working from beta software, although, you know, one of the learnings I've now had after 18 months of working on it already, it's like, it's easier to get people involved when it's stuff they've always wanted to use but haven't had a chance to use yet. Mm. And we have access to the team.
Yeah.
So, you know, more than one occasion through this effort, we've just called up Damian Edwards or, you know, David Fowler or one of these guys, and they just showed up and helped.
Yeah.
You know, like, which is pretty cool, right?
Yeah.
The developers are like, was that David Fowler? Yes, it was. But, you know, Sean Wildermuth, he's, you know, working on his book around ASP.NET Core. And as those big updates came to Core that broke everything,
yeah,
he had to fix all his demos anyway. And so had the whole thing in his head of what was going to break and was able to, you know, sit down and update. Okay, we're ready for RC1 now. Like those
right
sorts of things. So he may not have as many check-ins as other contributors, but they were vital. They were just at the right moment over a weekend. Sean got the app running again.
So as always happens, maybe 5-ish minutes into a conversation, I realize we should explain actually what is Humanitarian Toolbox.
So the short version of Humanitarian Toolbox is we build open source software for disaster relief organizations. Right?
Okay.
That's really what we settled on. Came to realize is that we could be good at. It was my motivation for starting in the first place was just an awareness that it was really hard for software developers to give their skills to charity. Because software is not really free, right? Software is free the same way a puppy is free. It needs to be taken care of. And responsible developers, they know this. And so if you're going to commit to contributing code to a charity, whatever form, you know, maybe it's a brochureware website, you know, the kind of thing you could actually do in a weekend kind of thing, you know that they have to live with that. You get to go home. Mm-hmm. They have to live with the site. And so it needs to be maintainable. And I know lots of folks who are so enamored, you know, the charity giving is so important to them that they simply commit to that's my charity. I work on this project every month or so. And they are sustaining themselves. But that's still, you know, one day you die, right? Like,
right.
So you go away. And who can take care of that, right? Software that can't be built is software that's effectively dead.
Mm-hmm.
So this was on my mind was, I know we want to use our skills for good and you know, move those things forward, but I don't want to burden a charity with anything.
Yeah.
And so how do we actually make really sustainable software?
Maybe you can tell us a little bit about what the application does.
Already.
Yes.
So we call it the toolbox because we have a bunch of apps, right? Now, I've held off lighting up too many in the early days of HT because I really wanted to deliver something. You know, it's very easy to get in this trap of, we'll do this, we'll do this, we'll do this, and just sort of disperse your efforts so that nothing gets finished. And Jim is famous and really resonated with me. He says, we're looking for outcomes here, not outputs.
Uh-huh.
And it's very easy to just, the output is code, but there's no useful outcomes that come
right,
from that.
Right, right.
So already, it's more of a preventative project. The initial implementation for it was for getting smoke detectors into homes that didn't have them. Doesn't sound like a huge problem, but it's an initiative that the Red Cross puts a lot of time into, right? If you don't have a smoke detector, you know, you're infinitely more in danger from what could be a minor fire, because it doesn't get detected right away, ends up burning you out of house and home and potentially loss of life. Mm-hmm. And so smoke detectors are cheap. Like, it's one of those hugely effective preventative things. So the Red Cross for many years has been doing these campaigns where they set up at a Home Depot and it's like, hey, let us install a smoke detector for you so that you can have one and take down names and phone numbers and so forth. And then they get skilled volunteers, volunteer firefighters, construction folks, so forth, who actually know the right place to put a smoke detector. Like, there is some training. There is a science to where do you put a smoke detector. You want it close enough to the bedrooms, high enough that it catches the early smoke, like all of these little details so that it's most likely to actually protect you. Now, those are skilled volunteers, and they only have so much time to give. And the important part around here is, like, let's use their time well. We're trying to get as many smoke detectors out there as we can. So, you know, what can you do? Now, pen and paper's fine. You can run a campaign that way, collect the data and so forth. It just takes longer.
Right.
And then you're going to take this list of addresses and try and sort them out so that you get a community, a group of them together, four or five, that you can give to this volunteer to say, okay, we'll go around this neighborhood. These are the people that have requested the smoke detector. And put them in. But we're software people. So think about that problem for just a little while and you sort of say, hey, you know what we can do?
Yeah, we can maybe do better.
We can go faster. And we can, you know, what does software do but allow us to do more with less resource or understand the problem faster? So, you know, that sorting mechanism for GIS, that's pretty easy in computing.
Yeah.
But same thing of getting that app onto the phone. So now the volunteer doesn't have to go to a central office to get paper or write things down. Stuff's more accurate. We're literally pinpointing the address. One of the latest features is a Twilio integration so that we can actually ping the home to say, we're on our way over.
Wow.
And the big thing we saw in the trials in 2016 when we were testing this, not completely feature complete, but you know, we're doing the first test, is we get a higher yield. You know, if 3 months ago, you said in a Home Depot, yeah, I wouldn't mind a smoke detector, and gave us your address, you may or may not remember when somebody comes knocking on your door, right? Mm. But if we are using software so that we're able to send you an email, like, this is the coming weekend, and sort of prep you for the fact that this is going to happen, you're more likely to be home. And so we went from, I think, about a 30% install rate to nearly an 80% install rate.
Wow.
And so, yeah, more effective all around.
So you mentioned ASP.NET Core. What's the technology kind of stack that's running all this stuff?
It's like I said, it's ASP.NET Core. It's basically a responsive web app. So the tech's not that – it's just not that fancy an application, right?
Okay.
I think there's a little bootstrap in there. And,
sure.
And we could sure use a UX designer. It definitely looks like software developers have built, for better or worse.
Yeah.
And if you think about it, there's a lot of things this piece of software could do. You know, and our mantra for Humanitarian Toolbox is, with the open source approach, is we don't pick winners here. If you want to use the software, it's on GitHub. Knock yourself out. Have a copy. Mm-hmm. Right? Make a contribution if you want, but we're not, you know, it's MIT licensed. We're not asking for anything. We worked with the Red Cross because they saw a need and we needed a domain expert to make sure we were doing the right things. I don't know about how to run a smoke detector installation campaign. So having someone like Jim around to walk us through what the needs are and how his volunteers think, what the model looks like, you know, that's what a domain expert does for us. But there's no doubt there's other organizations who are going to want to use this software.
So you work regularly with them then to kind of, I mean, obviously they're using it, but then also to kind of validate the priorities and features.
Yes, and we haven't gone to, it's not full up out in the field yet. That's happening this month, which is one of the reasons we've been talking so much about, you know, those the final details of getting out into the field. We've had field trials, which, like any field trial, we come back with a huge list of everything that's wrong with our software, right? No software survives contacts with the user. But Jim has been there in all of those Scrum meetings and getting together with us on a routine basis to make sure we're working on the right thing. Just the same as any product domain expert, right? That you need an expert. Without them, we'd just be making this stuff up.
Yeah.
And we really want to do the right thing. Right, I think it represents a really somewhat of a different style of an open source project. Like most open source projects, are somebody with a good idea, you know, often tooling for fellow developers. You know, if you think about most of the projects you look at on GitHub, and other people go, "Yeah, that is a good idea. Let me help you with that." Here we are doing much more of a traditional development model where we're serving as the HT guys, we're serving as the product managers, working with our domain expert to build up a set of requirements, you know, break that down into use cases and individual stories, and then we create issues in GitHub around them as individual work items for developers to pick up and contribute.
Great.
I was gonna say, it sounds like you operate maybe a little bit differently from other open source projects where you just have random drive-by pull requests by someone who is using it and wanted to change something.
Although, right? Admittedly, people aren't that random in pull requests,
well,
right?
True. Like,
and who would take a cold pull request out of the blue? You really hope that they would show up at talk a little.
Yes.
Right?
Yes,
and maybe submit it. You submit first as an issue. I mean, when I think about a more traditional model, it's like, I'm trying to use your tool. I can't make it work this way. Maybe it's me first, yeah. Right? Let us presume that I am not all-knowing and all-seeing. So am I just using this wrong? It's like, yeah, I know. I never really intended to do that way, but it's kind of interesting. So then you write it up as an issue. And you discuss with folks that are familiar with the project about how that should look and so forth. Then you commit to building it, right? But it all starts with your initial concern, you know, leading into an issue or two or three that turns into a pull request.
Yeah.
Right? Cool. You know, we've been doing that for years. Mm. Here we're writing the issues.
Yes.
Right? And we've learned, having run these codeathons, like, that you need some simple ones, right? You want a few jump-ins, easier things to be done. And so, you know, we consciously organize groups of issues for codeathons so that folks can to work on the right thing. And we've done the normal product planning thing where we have issues that are much broader scoped and you know, we'll get to this later kind of thing. But then we organize them in the milestones. So it's like, okay, getting to this particular feature set, here are the really ones we really want to get to, and those are the ones we'll focus on in a given event.
So one issue with some open source projects is you end up with a little bit of, what do they call it, the ball of mud, where, you know, people are like, here's a pull request, here's something.
Yes.
And it's kind of just all kind of not slapped together, but each thing is looked at separately. Do you have kind of a high-level architectural view or, you know, like, do you
have... Yeah, we definitely spent time thinking about what that software will look long-term and, you know, how are we ultimately going to be able to run this? Because now what's happened... We're probably just going to operate this for the organizations, right? Microsoft Philanthropies is around. We've been getting all the Azure we need. And so, you know, it's really an interesting conversation to talk to an organization like the Red Cross and say, how about we just run the app? And you just log in and use it. And
right.
We'll worry about the scaling and so forth because we know how to do that, right? It's easy to do all of that. So now we have gone through what the architectural plans and so forth would be for the project and then working through those implementations one piece at a time. One of the things that happened over this latest Codeathon here in the UK was exactly that. Let's go back through some of the old backlog that were thoughts that were too far in the future, because the future is now.
Yeah.
And we were talking about how to make sure this thing's going to run well in a multi-tenanted environment and what authentication strategies do we want to have available. And again, I'm leveraging years of working in this community to be able to just go to Dominic Beyer and Brock Allen and say, I'm thinking identity server. Can you help us? Yeah, we can. We're dealing with multiple time zones. Let's use Notatine. Here's John Skeet.
Right. Right.
So, and they're happy, you know, we're all just people trying to work on things that matter to us. And so John's thrilled to death that we want to use Notatine. Happy to spend a couple of hours helping the team get up to speed on it.
One of the things I took away from your keynote was that there's this huge universe of hardware out there with the Internet of Things, but not enough software to go around for these organizations to leverage some of that stuff, right?
Software is always going to lag the hardware.
Yep.
I think that's kind of normal. But I think the bigger thing here is that when you talk about charitable organizations and disaster response organizations, doubly so, they're not technical organizations, right? These people are focused on the meat and potatoes of saving lives. They know how to rappel from ropes. Like, they're kind of real superheroes. When you hang around with them for a while, it's like, you've done what? But the, you know, on a disaster site, like, these are the things they're focused on. And it's the right thing to be focused on, right? If you're working with water.org, they focus on water.
Yeah.
Right? You work with Red Cross, you know, they do blankets and cots and teddy bears and things to get to help regular people in times of distress get back to life. I don't want them to spend money on software. Mm-hmm. I'd rather we do it for our own reward of liking to build important things and give it away.
Right.
And it, and I've got enough backing now that I really think I can do that. Right. With the cloud organizations, not just Microsoft, the Google folks and the Amazon folks, they're all interested in saying, I have compute. If you have a problem, you can run on my compute to help these people here.
Yeah.
Right. And I have access to the skill sets to operate it. So now, you know, the real battle is us understanding the needs of these kinds of organizations to really make a dent in their problem space. What they don't necessarily understand is how much impact mobile and cloud will have for them.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about, you know, what most of us are doing in software today is implementing mobile and cloud to our enterprises, to our industries, to open that door. To what does that look like? This, the omni-channel selling is just a, doesn't matter whether I'm in the store, on the phone, at my laptop, or on my, you know, all of those things work.
Yeah.
Can we get disaster response to that place too? Because it's all got all the same potential, right? All of the same opportunity. I mentioned crisis check-in in the keynote as well. And at an angle on one of the feature sets we've been exploring for EnvoAd, which is, again, our sponsor organization around that project, is this citizen disaster evaluation. You know, the reality is that in a disaster, people take a picture of a damaged bridge and put it up on Twitter, a bridge, and put it up on Twitter and say, hey, you really should stay away from this bridge, probably sooner and more frequently than the disaster response workers can get to doing all those evaluations. So can we gather that data and assess its relative merit and so utilize the constrained resource of disaster response workers more efficiently? Right? That's a great thing for software to do, to be able to tap into social media, pull that data together and say, okay, of the 10 bridges we need to look at, here are pictures of all 10 of them. You better go look at this one first,
because
this is the one we probably need to close. Like, that's just an interesting way to think about that technology. And disaster response folks don't necessarily know, you know, how we would possibly do that, but we know.
You know,
once we understood the potential use case, it's like, oh, we can make that. There's an API to get at the to get at Twitter traffic. You're looking at these filters off of the Gestalt, and here's your data. Ta-da! And yeah, there's lots to build. Like, we're so far from getting through the stack of things. But, you know, the challenge for us has been to be organized in a way that we're not wasting anybody's time. We're working on the right thing. We're building in a way that's sustainable. Like, thinking about, how do I build software where nobody's in the critical path?
Yeah.
Right? That anybody can come and go, and we can keep working on the software.
And if someone's listening and interested, what can they do? Where do they go?
htbox.org. We do own humanitariantoolbox.com, so if you know how to spell humanitarian, you can go there too. It's the same site. htbox.org is the easy one. And we have a sign-up sheet there, so you can sign up and we'll send you an email and so forth. If you know your way around GitHub, github.org/htbox. There's all the projects.
Yeah.
You know, there are outstanding work items right now. I guarantee there are. And we've had folks that just appeared, they heard on it on a podcast or saw one of our advertisements, and they show up and see something they can contribute to, and they do.
You know, that pattern you talked about too, which I regularly see people that are approaching an open source project and not sure, and they will sometimes just jump in and send a big pull request or something, right? So the pattern you talked about too is the open an issue and let's talk about this thing. I think maybe this should work this way, or I'd like to get involved and help this thing, or find an open issue, of course.
Yes.
And say, and comment and say, like, hey, what about if I think I'll take this one, I'm going to do this and that. That's a pattern I see
that's
regularly.
That's been the normal pattern. Okay. And often one of the things that will happen is we have weekly Google Hangout-driven stand-ups for already.
Okay.
Run by James Chambers, who has essentially self-selected his way by sheer effort to help us manage the project, right?
Yeah.
And so we often bat us back and forth. But it's like, why don't you just drop in on the Hangout and be part of the Scrum call, and you'll get to talk to me and to Jim and to James and other contributors and get a sense for what we're doing.
Uh-huh.
And we do have a particular style to it. But every workout you've ever seen completed, if you go look at any of the pull requests, you'll see there was always a dialogue.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
This is what we were thinking. Here's where we got to. I think we should approach it like this. Here's why we've implemented these particular pieces so you can match up with it. And odds are there's somebody else who's contributed a piece right around that. It's probably the one you want to talk to. It's like, oh, yeah, I built the host for that part. Here's how you want to run that.
Are there any specific types of people that you're looking for right now? You mentioned like a designer before, which would be very helpful.
Lots of folks have been working on the ASP.NET Core side of this project, and that's been going very well. We need more mobile development.
What is your mobile stack? Is that Xamarin?
Depends on the project.
Okay.
Right now it's a responsive web page, but there's a big conversation going on about should we build a quote unquote native mobile clients for this app because they would be more responsive and so forth. And so I've actually asked and been contacted by folks saying, I know my way around Xamarin. I'm like, awesome. Be part of this conversation as we decide what's the right way to build this is. And, part of that's going to be looking from the context of a commitment, but also it's like, are these the right tools? In the use case where we were talking through this thing, I'm like, let's think about who actually needs to use this client because it's not us, right? We have iPhones and Android and Win phones, but when you're talking about a construction guy, he may just have a flip phone.
Yeah.
Right? And wrapped in a big rubber protector because they're kind of hard on gear, right?
Yeah.
So, that opened up a conversation to should our phone client be SMS driven, which totally doable if you think about it, right? It's sort of the modern chatbot model. Like, there's a bunch of cool stuff we could do in there.
Huh. That's true.
Right?
Hmm.
So, that's a good point. It's your normal productivity exercise.
So, Richard, you're the gadget guy. Other than Brian Randall, I don't know who else has more gadgets. So what's the latest thing, or what's the coolest thing you've gotten recently?
I'm absolutely enamored of my 43-inch 4K monitor, the Dell 4317.
This is curved?
It is not curved.
Okay.
Huh.
But it's 120 DPI 4K screen. So I'm at 100%. I'm not zooming at all.
Wow.
You get to use all the pixels.
Okay.
Right. Most 4Ks are the DPI is so high, you end up scaling everything.
Yes.
This is totally unscaled, and so I'm just getting used to where do you put the windows?
Yeah.
Because those outer corners on that screen, they're a long way away.
Do you use some software for window arrangement? I mean, that's some of what I see people dealing with these big high. High resolution screens.
Yes, I haven't committed to anything at the moment.
Uh-huh.
The machine that it's the screen set that it's replacing is from 2006, which was actually the very first Apple 30-inch, which actually a Philips tube, 2560 by 1600, and then I hung 1600 by 1200 displays on either side of it, so that I had 4960 by 1600. which, rule number one is no mouse pad is big enough. You're going to need a rollerball. but that screen's down more than 10 years old and just not as crisp and clean as modern IPS. And so when I saw that 43, I'm like, oh, I think I need to have that.
And you just finished a home remodel, an office remodel, and all that, too.
Finished is an interesting term.
You are finishing.
Remodel meaning I had 2 inches of water across my whole basement. It's been more than a year, right? It was November of 2015 that the flood happened.
Wow.
But I'm fortunate enough to be married to a woman whose reaction to we have 2 inches of water in the basement is to roll out the plans and say, so what did you want to change?
Yeah.
And she got a new office out of the deal, too. So of the 7 rooms that were flooded, 4 of them had significant renovations done to them, including my office. And the other thing, and we've been talking about this on the show, is I went to low voltage lighting, the LED lighting throughout the basement.
Okay.
And it passed the wife test, which is not an easy thing to do. But when she – I ended up having to become a dealer because I was the only person who was interested in my area. So fine, I signed up for the training. Oddly enough, I passed. And then could show her the different sample lights, and she found stuff that she liked, and we were able to outfit the house with it. So we went from 4 15-amp circuits of lighting in the basement to 1.
Wow.
A big power reduction.
And then you previously had a server closet, basically.
I still do.
You still do.
Yes,
all right.
I do.
Any changes with that?
It was 18 inches off the ground, not okay. by accident. Uh-huh. Right. So I used Middle Atlantic rolling racks. So rather than building sort of a traditional server space, the racks are bolted to the ground and it's a walk-around space. Mm-hmm. These racks are built more like a closet, so they actually sit on carriages 18 inches off the ground, but they can be slid out to work on them. So you can put them closer together. The space is much smaller, which makes it easier to cool, because it does have an air conditioner and so forth in it to run, and very well soundproof. So
okay.
The spooky part of that closet, if you get a chance to see it, is it has doors that look like closet doors, but on the other side is electronic mayhem. But those doors are very insulating, so when you click them together, you hear this click, and the noise just disappears. I spent a lot of time thinking about those doors.
One of the questions we often ask guests, because we record so often, is
often being a relative term, right?
What do you do when you're not doing technology?
I run a charity. Unfortunately, it's a technology charity. Mm. I love getting off the grid, so I am prone to hiking in the Himalayas. That's my soft spot. I've traveled extensively. I think I've been to about 93 countries now.
Wow.
And one of my favorite places in the world is Nepal. So if I can get an excuse to go up off the grid, I will. And it's three or four weeks at a time. I have a group of Sherpa that I've known for many years now. We'll go somewhere, place nutty. A few years ago, with a couple other tech folks you may know, guys like Joel Semeniak and Stephen Forte, we went to Lomontang. So that's the region right up against, in Nepal, right up against Tibet, the route that the Dalai Lama used to escape in the 1950s from the invasion. And very restricted area, very fragile environment. And just an opportunity to see ancient stuff a group of people that have lived a different style for a very long time. While it's deserty, high and dry, these are people's homes. They live there, and we would hike from one valley to the next for a few weeks until we got all the way to Lomontang.
Wow.
All right. Well, thanks a lot. I mean, we could talk for hours, but this is probably a good.
We probably good place. Will. We'll just stop recording.
Yeah. Right. Well, thanks a lot. And then again, to kind of circle back, anyone that wants to get involved, htbox.org is the place to get started.
Htbox.org is an easy way to get started. GitHub/htbox for the projects. We have the @htbox handle on Twitter, which you'll see us tweet out not only when we're doing events, but also whenever we do stand-ups. So if you actually want to just sit in and see what's going on, there's a YouTube channel for the same thing. All of those stand-ups end up there, so you can go back and have a review of the various projects we're working on. Mm. And like I said, we are at a tipping point right now where we're ready to start, as Already goes out the door, and development's never going to stop on Already. There's lots to be done still. The list is long, but we're seeing that we can get more project management resources on board. That's our gate. Project management resources. And so as the charity gets the money to keep those project resources moving, we will be lighting up more projects.
All right. Well, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you again soon on Herding Code.